the past 3 or 4 months, it's really unfortunate. We've seen a lot of these companies that had great prospects originally actually shut their doors. And simply because, you know, they didn't foresee the funding being cut off and still hadn't figured out how to achieve a specific product market fit or get the cash flow positive.
This is Retained Learnings, a podcast where Canadian finance leaders share strategic advice and potential solutions to answer some of the finance department's most important questions. I'm your host, Rob Kazam, the founder and CEO of Float. Thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode.
Hi, I'm Andrew Dale, SVP of Operations and Financial Products at Float. I'm filling in for our CEO, Rob Kazam, today, and I'm excited to sit down with this week's guest, Josh Zweig. Josh is the co-founder and CEO of LiveCA, Canada's leading online accounting firm. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew.
So, Josh, I'm always interested to learn what makes people choose a certain career path. So why don't you tell the audience what led you to choose a career in accounting and specifically to pursue a CPA?
Sure. I won't give you my whole life story, but effectively I was in philosophy in Western Huron University. So I did that for 2 years and figured I'm not going to make a lot of money as a professional philosopher, switched into business school. And in business school, I had an accounting professor that really liked, and it was quite inspirational, I think, to a lot of folks there. And she encouraged a lot of us to pursue a CPA as a designation that would teach you a lot about business and how the inner workings of a business function. And so that's what led me down the path of then joining a Big Four to pursue my CPA and then eventually start my own firm.
When you join a Big Four firm, a lot of people might view that with a cynical eye as they enter that type of work environment. What were you able to take in a positive light from the Big Four, and what types of things might you want to leave behind from that type of experience?
So this is a really good question. So my experience in the Big Four, and I think everyone has a different experience, but certainly being in downtown Toronto and an audit, so I was auditing a lot of banks and insurance companies, and I think it really opened my eyes as to what audit actually is, and perhaps I had a much more idealized version of what it would be like to get my CPA, and that really got me down to earth. It's like, oh, this is what it is. It's a lot of number matching, and I wasn't using my brain as I thought I was going to do. So it did teach me a lot about how larger organizations work and the politics of working within a larger organization. And so in some sense, it helped me decide what I didn't want to do, and then led me to eventually a smaller firm.
That makes a lot of sense. And as you transitioned into that smaller firm, did you find that the environment was different, or you were doing more meaningful work, or it still wasn't enough for you?
So I left a Big Four after about a year there, and I thought auditing, certainly not for me, CPA, perhaps not for me. And I left, and I actually went to Tel Aviv, and I did all kinds of random jobs there. I was an air conditioner installer. I was worked in a restaurant. I worked retail. I was in the army, and then learned very quickly that, okay, a career as a military plumber is not something I'm going to pursue, so I should probably finish the CPA thing. Because while I was there, I realized I had passed what at the time was the UFI, which is now the CFI. And so I ended up back in Canada and struggled to find a job and ended up working for this really small firm that actually had half their clientele in Israel and half the clientele in Canada. And I remember the first day on the job, because when I was at the Big Four, everything's super professional. It's very, very organized. It's very hierarchical. And so you always have to ask permission if you're going to speak to a client or somebody within the organization. And I remember getting a file on my desk and going to my boss and saying, hey, you know, I've got a few questions for the client. Can I give him a shout? And my boss, he's about, 70-year-old plus Israeli guy. And he just looked at me and said, Josh, I don't give up. I'm going to beep that. But what you do, just give me the file done. I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll like working here. And so it was a very resourceful type of work environment where I just had to figure out how to get things done. And I learned, like, that's the best way I learn.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it seems like you got a taste, even in that more traditional accounting world, of that entrepreneurial experience, which leads me to really you founding LiveCA. I mean, traditionally, it'd be a huge leap to go from being in public accounting to founding your own business. It seems like you had a bit of an interim bridge through that small firm, but what made you ultimately take the leap into doing it yourself versus staying somewhere entrepreneurially and small?
So I think, I mean, often in a lot of entrepreneurial stories is a story of I wanted to disrupt and do something different. I didn't, to be honest, at the beginning. I actually liked working for the small firm that I was working at, but I still wanted to get, because I'd spent so long in Tel Aviv, I wanted to get back there. And about 3 years working with this small firm, I realized that the majority of the work I could do online. So I was logging into Caseware online, I was scanning in all the documents. So I was showing the firm, you know, here, we can do this paperless. And of course, this is like over 15 years ago. And so I then eventually approached my boss. He says, look, how about we work out a deal where I continue to work for you? In fact, you can pay me less. I'll fly in a couple times a year on my own dime, and I'll live in Tel Aviv, and you know, I'll do the files, and I'll talk to the clients, and what do you think? And he looked at me and says, Josh, if you're not in the office, you're not working. So I thought, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to do this on my own. So it was really that push that encouraged me to start my own firm. And in fact, this particular boss, which I actually quite respect, in a weird, bizarre way, he encouraged me to do that on my own. He's like, Josh, if you're not sure, you should do it on your own. You'll fail and you'll come back here, but you should try. So that's encouraging, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. You got that entrepreneurial push from someone who seemed to care about you on a deeper level. Did you have a vision at the time you founded LiveCA? Was it to become a leading, you know, Canadian online accounting firm? Was the ambition different? Was it to build a lifestyle business? Like, or was it just about, you know, going out on your own and seeing what came of it? What was your drive?
So I had said to my partner at the time that I was going to be the accountant with no pants, because it was really to be on Skype. And, you know, the dream was to be able to work from somewhere else, like a place where I wanted to live, and, you know, run on the beach in the morning and eat hummus and then have a couple clients and do a number of calls and be able to do the calls in my shorts. You know, that was the idea. Ironically, a couple of years later, the book by Automattic came out called The Year Without Pants. So should have written something earlier. But the vision at the beginning was actually quite a lifestyle vision, which is for myself, which is I can integrate work within the ideal lifestyle that I'd like to live. Interestingly enough, when we eventually hired our first employee, I didn't realize that you could actually impart this particular lifestyle on someone else. And the first employee, he said to me something to the tune of, you know, I can't believe I actually found my dream job. And I was like, oh, you know, perhaps there's something deeper here when you're able to share this dream lifestyle, this idea of work-life integration with someone else. That gave me a different sense of purpose and perhaps a different vision of what the original vision was, which is primarily for myself.
That's really, really interesting. So it seems like the lifestyle piece was coming into play, but ultimately you still had to get customers and demonstrate credibility while wearing no pants. So how did you do that? How did you get your first customers? Can you share who they were? And what was that sales cycle or, you know, winning process like?
So for the record, I wore pants because I was too chicken to not wear pants during the first few years. In fact, I was so preoccupied with the fact that people were going to think I was that professional. So I bought this white screen and I put it behind me so people would think I'm in an office. I put my degrees up as well and my accounting degrees. Sometimes I wore a suit and tie as I was sitting. So I kind of went the other way at the beginning until I realized that people didn't really care. Because I was in Tel Aviv, so there was a, you know, 7 to 10 hour time difference depending where you are in Canada. So I had this like a really old voice over IP phone with this big red flashing light, kind of like the bat phone. And I put it beside my bed just in case people would call, you know, at the end of business hours in Canada. I would sometimes wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning, go, you know, hello, LiveCA, just to pretend, you know, I'm not, definitely not in a, you know, across the world waking up in the middle of the night. You are calling in an office in Canada. So, that's what I did at the beginning. And to be honest, it was a huge lesson in humility because I had been to a prominent business school before. And the messaging I received in business school was, you are the leaders of tomorrow. So I thought, I am so smart. And when I got and launched my own business, I was like, oh, it's actually really hard. It's really hard to get customers. And they don't think that I'm that smart right away. And, you know, I was struggling. I was negotiating over 150 for a tax return versus 130. I mean, this is what I was spending my time on. So the first 6 months, I really struggled to get customers. The traction came once I met my partner, Chad. And so Chad was doing systems integration. So he was one of the first people in Canada to migrate people over to Xero, so cloud accounting software, and I was doing the taxes. And so he said, well, why don't we work together? I'll do the taxes for your 6 clients, and you can do the systems integrations for my 6 clients. And eventually those 12 clients said, this is really cool that you've combined the service, and that's what led to traction. And so one of our first clients together was actually Flixel. And so that was one of our first tech clients. So shout out to Phil, who believed in us from the beginning. And that actually started to lead to other tech clients that signed up with us.
So you started to develop this niche in tech. Was that a word of mouth sort of referral motion? Were you doing any marketing from afar? What was that motion?
So we did very, very little marketing at the beginning. And it was mostly word of mouth. And perhaps given that there were not a lot of online options, we were effectively the first online option in Canada, and certainly the first to be recognized by CPA Ontario as an official CPA firm that could then train students virtually. So a lot of tech companies that were the early adopters of online systems, they were the people that were very okay with this way of working. Some others needed a lot more convincing that online was the way to go. And we learned pretty quickly that trying to convince somebody that the internet was a good thing was not at the time our ideal customer. And so we were getting lots of tech companies that wanted to work with us. And then one of the more prominent tech companies that started to work with us, which really, I think, opened the floodgates for us, was Wealthsimple.
Wow.
And we started with them when they were really small. And that led to a whole host of other pretty prominent Canadian tech companies that started with us when they were very small teams that eventually scaled to sometimes hundreds of people.
Yeah, Wealthsimple's obviously built an amazing brand. What does it take to build trust as a key service provider or vendor to a prominent company like that?
I mean, I think it's like any service. You just have to do good work, right? If you do what you say you're going to do and you do it well, effectively that's what builds trust.
And this long predated, you know, the virtual work days of the pandemic, right? You were really cutting edge at that point.
Yeah, there weren't, I mean, certainly that I knew of, there weren't a lot of companies that operated 100% remote in the way that we did. So we kind of had to learn as we went as to, you know, how to do things like build culture when you're doing remotely. So we did things like, which now looking back are perhaps not as fiscally responsible as I would have liked, but we did these massive retreats and we got people together in different parts of the world sometimes to get together, which was quite cool. And I think did spark a lot of the culture that we created at LiveCA. But again, we were just kind of making it up as we went along.
That's really, really neat. When did you feel that LiveCA really had traction? Was it a number of clients, a revenue threshold, an employee count, or just an overall feeling when you felt that?
So as I say, put your money where your mouth is. I think the when we hired our first employee, I argue is when we said, okay, this thing has legs. And that's where I asked my dad for a loan. And so he gave us some money. And that's when we actually started to go into cash flow negative and try to grow it like a tech company. Because we were signing on, could have been 10 customers per month. And the team grew pretty, pretty quickly. Almost like 50% per year in terms of growth. Wow. for a number of years.
Wow, that's a really, you know, accelerated growth rate. And so you enter this hyper growth phase with some, you know, friends and family capital versus venture funding, which is a neat choice. And it seemed like LiveCA grew really tremendously, you know, to 120 employees. You're saying 50% year-over-year growth. What were some of the positive takeaways from that hyper-growth phase?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, behind that question is the sustainability of that growth phase, and that perhaps we'll talk about that in a bit. You know, and at the time, that unfortunately wasn't top of mind. But certainly the positive, I mean, it's if you think of, you know, what gets people behind a company, it's the sense of excitement, of inspiration, of purpose. And so I suppose we did a lot of things right to gain that kind of traction from a culture perspective. which was like those retreats, for example. We took the team to a place called Bear Camp, where they were in these like really luxury tents and got to do all these activities overlooking these grizzly bears. We took the team, we rented a house in Vegas and had like 30 people in this house. It was like Big Brother. Like you couldn't, I don't think you could do this today, but that, at the time we thought that was super cool. We went camping with the team. So we did all kinds of just cool stuff. If we thought something was cool, we did it. And that was sort of our mantra for many years, including just testing new apps within the business. So it was always like, let's break stuff. And so we would do something until it didn't work, or try new things and sell new services, some of which were complete failures. So I think a lot of that energy is what made us, what was quite positive at the beginning. And today, as we're much more mature and sustainable, still forms that concept of innovation of let's do things different, or let's break things and see what happens, or experimentation still forms a part of our DNA.
Really neat, really entrepreneurial mindset, especially in the space that you were coming from, to demonstrate that kind of innovation.
Yeah, and we've since come around as to how entrepreneurial we want the organization to be. And arguably, we went too far into the entrepreneurial space, where we forced our employees to be way too entrepreneurial and take on a lot of risk in terms of managing their own customer base and their own time. And ultimately, we learned that, for us anyway, that employees join our organization not to be business owners and to bear the stress and risk that a business owner bears, but perhaps work within an entrepreneurial type of organization. So we've since obviously scaled that back. Not that we're less entrepreneurial, but just not to put the onus on employees to figure it out without enough support from the organization.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. I think you have to adapt to your staff's style in a way to elicit the results that you want to achieve, but in a way that makes sense for them so that the whole company acts in harmony.
Well, I can give you an example, and this is certainly in the cloud accounting industry. There's quite a lot of talk around value pricing, and there always was. And we are a big proponent of value pricing, and a value pricing is essentially pegging a value to the service, and not necessarily taking into account the cost. And perhaps if cost is in our case of a professional service firms, the cost of is time, right? Time doesn't necessarily translate into 1 hour equals X unless the whole company is operating at capacity. And so we did that for about 10 years, which is we had a whole value discussion with a customer to understand, as a simple example, if we're replacing two people in the team, the two people cost the organization, I don't know, 15 grand a month, we could do what they were doing for 5 grand a month. So, okay, the value is, you're saving the organization 10 grand. And so you could charge them instead of 5, maybe 7, something like that. Now, so Chad and I did the pricing. We were the pricers for many years until we thought, oh, well, actually our managers can manage their own business units and they'll figure out pricing. And that just created so much stress for the managers, because all of a sudden they had to be responsible for delivering the service, the customer relationship, doing the optimal pricing. And it was just too much. And, perhaps we learned in hindsight. So a great learning experience. But again, now we have a separate team, a customer success team. We do pricing. We've changed our pricing model. So just an example of putting too much on an employee.
Yeah, and not shipping that ambiguity down to the organization, at least to the staff who aren't necessarily ready, or maybe at different points in their career in terms of being able to handle that ambiguity and drive that type of decision-making themselves.
Well, in the case, an example that I gave, ultimately you're basically telling your team members that they have to operate like a business. Hey, you have to make sure your customer base is profitable, and the feedback was like, hey, love learning the skill set, but this isn't sustainable. Like if I screw this up, then the client will get pissed, or they'll leave, or I'll create burnout for my team. So again, just a lot of risk on that particular team member.
Josh, at a similar moment in time, there was an online accounting firm in the US called Pilot, and it took an entrepreneurial path as well, but with a lot more capital. It raised venture capital from Sequoia. I believe Jeff Bezos's investment firm backed them to the tune of $150 million in total financing. Why did you choose not to do that? You had similar entrepreneurial ambitions or a similar style to growth. Why did you not take that type of capital and choose to go with friends and family type of money?
I wish I could say that I turned down $150 million in investment, but that was not the case. And to be honest, we actually did try to do that for a time. And, you know, we're in a very different place today. And if I could do it all over, perhaps not do that. But we did take investments. We had friends and family. We took money from a bank, from BDC. We took money from a private investor. And we did for many years. The growth I was talking about was unsustainable growth. We were not cash flow positive for many years, which is why I ended up, again, and we're going to tie this to the lifestyle, but, you know, whereas we began the firm so that we could have a great life and do high impact work, I found myself in 2019 working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, just to sell, to get more clients into the system so that we could eventually be cash flow positive before our funding didn't run out. And I'd have to go with my tail between my legs to, you know, ask for even more money. So we did do that. And I just, you know, I felt the personal toll of experiencing panic attacks and complete burnout. And that trickles down to the team.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Those are tough moments. Would you say those panic attacks and burnout moments were some of the toughest ones for you over the last decade? Do some reflection here. What were those low moments as you built LifeCA over the last decade?
Yeah, that was a low moment. There was, I mean, a bit of the, I think often we idealize the entrepreneurial lifestyle, and you have books like The 4-Hour Work Week that make it seem like starting a business is easy, and then once you do it, you can have this great life. And so I left Tel Aviv after about 2.5 years, and the business was stable again, and moved to Colombia, to Medellin, with the notion that I was going to come back to Israel within a month. And that was, I think, over 11 years ago. So my stuff is still with my cousins in Israel. But I was in Medellin. I was trying to, I think, replicate some of that lifestyle. So I was getting up early to work in Colombia. Then I was going to work out. Then I did a Spanish lesson. Then I did a salsa lesson. Then I'd go on a date. And then I'd go back to salsa dancing. So I had this like insanely packed schedule that I was trying to manage, not necessarily recognizing like, oh, I had a hard day at work, maybe I should rest. No, there was none of that, because I wanted to, I think, prove to myself that I could do everything. And eventually that whole system collapsed when I think I was on a date in 2019, and I was telling one of my stories that I would always tell, and I started to sweat and palpitate. And I said, I think I have to excuse myself. And I got all dizzy, and I thought, oh, geez, I'm going to faint here. And I said to the person I was with, I was like, I think I have to go because I'm going to faint. And she just kind of looked at me like surprised. And I paid the bill and just like ran home. And from then on, it was like 6 months before I could actually regain just some of that internal stability to be outside without freaking out. And so that was a really difficult time. That's where I started therapy. So there was a lot of things I had to do to self-regulate, and just because of all the buildup that I had done in the previous years.
Thanks so much for opening up about this. What were the key lessons that you took from all that work you did with yourself, whether through therapy or you call it self-regulation? What did you take away from that period?
I mean, so much. Like there's so many new habits that I developed due to that period. So if I look at my routine then versus now, my routine then was get up, open the laptop, start working with a coffee. And it was like starting the day from 0 to 100. And today I get up, I have water with lemon, I write in the gratitude journal, I meditate, I then open my laptop maybe like an hour later, and I organize my day. I've got a 2-hour workout in the morning, and then I come back. So the pace of my day is very, very different. And I'm thankful to both being able to do 5 years of therapy and coaching, which I've both continued to do. That's allowed me to have a lot more self-awareness as to when I'm accelerating too much. And then when I notice that about myself, I'm able to then pull back. So perhaps I would say that the largest lesson is simply an increased self-awareness. Mm.
And it seems like that's translated in 2024 into a renewed sense of purpose within your business, that there's a direct correlation between the work you've done personally and how you've, you know, imbued that, or how you're imbibing that, you know, in LifeCA. Can you talk about how your vision's evolved or your purpose has evolved?
Yeah. So in every good story, there's like a catalyst. There's like that moment, right? So for me, that moment personally came in 2019 with panic attacks, when I said, okay, I got to change something. Similarly, I think often the leaders or the state of a leader of an organization, it can be any organization, that state starts to influence the organization itself. And I'd say LiveCA as well hit a moment, its own version of a panic attack as well. And so after COVID, we started a process to look for some significant investment in the firm. And the just like you mentioned, Pilot, I mean, this is at a time when VCs were looking at cloud accounting firms as growth engines that you could then value on using revenue multiples, right? And not profit multiples, as you would think. So we went down that route and we thought, okay, well, let's see if we can get some, a few million dollars and go to the pilot route. And what would that look like to grow LiveCA in that scale? And we put the organization under a lot of stress to be able to hit growth targets to prove that we were growing at the rate that justified a particular valuation. And we were 1 week from closing with a potential investor. And 1 week before close, they pulled out, citing effectively the tech recession and saying, well, you know, we're not doing any deals right now. And this is already in 2022 when the tech universe realized, oh, shoot, we actually have to look at sustainability and profitability a little bit more seriously. And that led us into a path of, because we were burning a lot of cash to hit these growth targets. So we tried outsourcing for a while to outside of the country, and that was an absolute disaster. We learned a lot, but we was effectively betraying our team. So we just stopped that project, killed that project after 6 months, and have since, so that was our big catalyst moment, and have since come around and said, okay, hold on a second. The whole purpose of the organization was the idea of high impact work, so doing meaningful work for customers and having a really good life, and we're not doing either right now. Mm-hmm. And so we restructured the entire organization. We're now 55 people. We changed our pricing model, and we're going a lot slower, right? And if you look at the engagement scores today of employees, it's the highest they've ever been, right? And that comes from, I think, making the practical changes in the organization, the hard changes, to be much more congruent with the original vision.
Have you restated your mission or vision statement at all, or do you feel like you're just more living it day to day?
So I think for us, we got the vision right at the beginning. Perhaps we didn't express it or articulate it in a way the same way as we do today. We didn't put it down on paper at the time, but it hadn't really changed, right? I mean, Chad was the same. Chad left, he was living in Cayman Islands with his family and wanted to do something entrepreneurial. Today, Chad lives, he's been going, I think, 6 years strong, lives in an RV with his wife, two kids, two dogs.
Amazing.
So he's living a very interesting, and some people would say dream life, right? But during the years that we were growing LiveCA, he was working 18 hours in his basement. So we lost that, like we had the vision statement, but we lost sight of it, arguably because we were jealous of other companies that were growing at that rate and we wanted our share of the pie. And I think that was, we learned the hard way, kind of like that Disney moment, that we had the right vision all along. We just lost the way, and today we're far more connected with that.
That's wonderful to hear. What do your employees remark on in terms of the new, shape of LiveCA?
So we comment on it all the time, and we have just in our Slack channel, we have a channel called Heartbeat where people give public appreciation posts, and so at the end of the year, it was really heartwarming just to see the posts as to just people commenting how much LiveCA has changed over the past year and how much it's a better place to work. We had people, as we were making the changes in early 2023, we had old employees actually come back to the organization that had left, including some customers as well. So you could see that, I mean, the changes were felt as a complete 180 just in terms of the way we operated the organization. And today, for example, we have during tax season, people are working normal hours. They're able to take weekends. They're able to take a day like family day. And that just wasn't possible in the past. We were to close for a week for the Christmas holiday, right? So there are a lot of things that we can do today that are much more congruent with our vision that we would have wanted to in the past, but never actually did.
Mm. Amazing to hear. And yet you have two founders, you and Chad, who are really living nomadically, really interesting lives, as you're saying. How do you stay connected while being fully remote, from your co-founder, but also from your staff?
So there's a lot of things that I think an organization, at the end of the day, if it's fully remote, has to be very intentional in how they build culture. I would say it's actually far harder, and I think we've seen a lot of that after COVID, to go from an in-person experience to then go to virtual, because you effectively have to rebuild all these practices and do different things. So if you're used to running into people at the water cooler, you got to figure out, like, how are we going to replace that? For us, because we started virtual, so we didn't have to rethink any of the type of behaviors that we did. And you had this weird blip where all the in-person stuff that we used to do, we couldn't do for like 12 to 18 months, right, during that whole period. So we're starting to do things now in person again. For example, in the leadership team, we meet up each quarter. We run on EOS, which is a whole other topic. But so we do meet up each quarter to set up priorities for the following quarter. And we're starting to see, like, okay, how can we encourage more meetups with other employees? But virtually, we do things like Donut, which is people meet each other randomly every 3 weeks, and social calls and games calls and things like that that bring the team together virtually.
That makes a lot of sense. I want to shift a little bit to the broader landscape in Canada. You outlined previously the changes that happened during the pandemic versus, you know, the early years of building the company. And now it really does seem like we're in a new, you know, era where Canadian companies, some of them are thriving, you know, others have shut down. The last 2 years have really been hard for some Canadian companies. And from your vantage point, is there anything that the best performing companies are doing differently than others that we can all learn from?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the past, right, the idea was spend the VC money that you get, that you receive. And this is, when we're talking in tech, so spend the VC money that you receive just in terms of in order to grow the company to get to the next round. And I mean, really in the past 3 or 4 months, it's really unfortunate. We've seen a lot of these companies that had great prospects originally actually shut their doors. And simply because, you know, they didn't foresee the funding being cut off and still hadn't figured out how to achieve a specific product market fit or get to cash flow positive. And so they've been either forced to close or get acquired or do something completely different. And if we look at the successful companies, I mean, ultimately, those are the companies that figured out how to come up with their or carve out their own destiny themselves by reaching some sort of sustainability, right? Some sort of cash flow positive, which doesn't pit them into this corner of having to get acquired or look for more capital.
What do you think generates sustainability? Is that an honest assessment about whether there's product market fit? Is that a management philosophy? Is that hard numbers in terms of what you're willing to spend on the cost side? What is it that generates sustainability for these leading companies?
I mean, I think it's, I don't think it's that complicated. I mean, it's hard to achieve it, right? But sustainability, if I look at the sort of the trifecta or the pillars that are important in the business, you've got employees, customers, and profit, right? Which is the glue that holds it together. So if you have, for example, really happy employees because you're paying at the top pay grade, and you've got lots of perks, but you're not profitable, well, you know, ultimately not sustainable. If you're profitable, but you're not treating your employees well and you're not treating your customers well, I'd argue that that is also not sustainable. So this is an exclusive, financial stability. If you're treating your customers really well and perhaps you're treating them well because you're subsidizing, right, which a lot of tech companies do, what would be the true pricing of a particular product, right? That's not sustainable either, because eventually you're going to have to raise prices and then all of a sudden you might lose all your customers. So I think it's finding the balance between happy customers, happy team members, and profit.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think knowing what the true value and cost of your services in the market is important, not just one or the other, but what does this actually cost to create a sustainable, you know, cost profile for your company? What about technology? Do you think whether AI or other technological tools, that those tools have a role to play in helping Canadian companies become more efficient? Have you seen that play out?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that, for example, using an AI to just in our business to draft a summary email is helpful. To start a memo is helpful. There are companies out there that are figuring out how to use AI to do bookkeeping a lot quicker. So absolutely, we know that AI is going to shape the landscape. I think it's how you respond to that within the company. So just to take an example of using AI to write an email, I think we run the risk, if we don't have proper AI policies, that the people that are joining our organizations are going to not learn how to think. How do you write a good email that's empathetic to a customer, that's detail oriented enough, but not too much detail, right? Those are skills that they're really important in an organization, particularly if you're going to be reviewing emails later on. And so I think if we're not intentional about it, we just run the risk of people using AI and not actually developing those skills themselves to be able to assess, well, how good is this final product?
Yeah, so I'm hearing that it can be a good tool for productivity, but within prescribed parameters to not compromise strategic thinking, empathy, and core sort of human traits that you want in your staff.
100%.
That makes a lot of sense. We're going to move on to some rapid fire questions. What's the craziest thing you've seen someone try to expense?
I won't say where it happened and in what context, but I've seen someone that had a buying and selling car business, but surprisingly, he only bought cars, and they were luxury cars, and the only person that drove the cars were himself. And so, yeah, you can expense a Ferrari or a Porsche. It looks great in the books.
Easy to catch?
Easy to catch, yeah, I suppose. Depends on your risk threshold.
Can you recommend a podcast, conference, book, other resource that you'd recommend to our audience here in Canada?
Yeah, so I read a lot. I read before bed. I read a lot in general, but I discovered Audible a couple years back, and I also realized that I don't really want to be reading necessarily in bed about marketing strategies for my business. And so I've since transitioned to reading fiction in bed on my Kindle. And then when I'm on the go, when I work out, wherever, I listen to Audible. So that for me has been that's where I listen to all my nonfiction.
Can you name a finance leader and a non-finance leader that you admire?
Well, just the top of mind finance leader, and I don't think this is not a globally recognized name, but it was my old boss in a bizarre way, in the sense that I learned what not to do, how not to run an organization, and I learned a lot from him. And so what I learned from my old boss was that, if I contrast that to a big four, it was all about doing things properly, right? According to the book, without, and this is the thing in audit, it wasn't about customer satisfaction, it was about following the auditing rules, fine. But when I went to a small firm, he's the one who taught me, because I asked him how to do things right. He's like, Josh, it's not about doing things right. The customer's happy, are we getting paid? That's a bad accent. But so the point is it was him that taught me about, consider what the customer wants to do, right? The customer's risk threshold, how much tax the customer wants to pay, and make sure that we're getting paid in the engagement, right? So I learned a lot from him.
That makes sense. Anybody else you look up to in the business world?
So this is a complete side note, but I went to Antarctica in December and climbed a mountain there and met some pretty incredible people. And one of the people that I met there was this guy who was, he's the largest importer of rubber snakes in the world. And his inspiration was because he saw Top Gun, and he said, there's a line apparently in Top Gun, which is, I'm going to corner that market or something like that. So he thought, like, what market could actually take over that, it doesn't have a lot of competition. So he picked the rubber snake market, and apparently is very, very successful. But despite his success, I mean, he could retire 10 times over. He's still very involved in this business. He's still, their business has a climbing wall in it. They've got all kinds of sort of adventure activities within the office. And he takes this an incredible trip. And it's not luxury trips. It's like things like, let's replicate Shackleton's journey, across the Drake Passage. So he's done some pretty incredible adventures. And so he's somebody I think that I look up to.
Amazing. Thanks for sharing. Josh, thanks so much for coming in. This was super interesting, and it's great to have you on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Retained Learnings. We want to reach as many Canadian finance professionals as possible. So if you have 2 minutes to spare, we'd love for you to rate and review the new show. Sharing on social media helps too, and you can tag @Flowcard. I'm Rob Kazam, and until next time, take care. We'll